Welcome to the City of Eugene's January 13, 2017 program. And it is titled, What I Learned from About a Vision Zero in Sweden and Denmark. This is the 14th program in a current programming year, 2016-2017 programming year. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Club Board President. We can fulfill our mission thanks to your membership and support from many people out there, but also from sponsors, including the Oregon Country Fair. The Oregon Country Fair creates events and experiences that nourish the spirit, explore living artfully and authentically on earth, and transforms culture in magical rehabilitative counseling. And KLCC 89.7 NPR Radio for Oregonians. A special thanks to the University of Oregon's Baker Center for graciously hosting us every Friday. Also, want to take a quick second to say special thanks to Mary Layton for her baseline work in the Minority and Emerging Leaders Committee. She is moving on from this assignment to another and focusing her energy into the fundraising committee. So please welcome and say thank you to Mary for us. Today's program, titled What I Learned About Vision Zero in Sweden and Denmark, is coordinated by Sandy Erickson. Our speaker today is Matt Rodriguez, a Eugene traffic engineer in the City of Eugene Public Works Department. He was awarded the American Public Works Association Jennings Randolph International Fellowship to study implementation of Vision Zero in Sweden and Denmark. Vision Zero is a multinational road traffic safety project that aims to achieve a highway system with no fatalities or serious injuries in road traffic. It all started in Sweden, and it was approved by their parliament in October of 1997. A core principle of the vision is that, quote, life and health can never be exchanged for other benefits within the society, end quote. As opposed to the more conventional comparison between costs and benefits, in which a monetary value is placed on life and health, and then that value is used to decide how money to spend on road networks. This type of approach puts a cost benefit on reducing risk instead of saving lives. We look forward to hearing about Matt's experiences in Sweden and Denmark and his first-person perspective and valuable insight into how other countries are implementing life savings techniques and how they might translate in Eugene. That's why we're doing this program. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Matt Rodriguez.
Thank you. So as Juan Carlos said, I'm Matt Rodriguez. I'm the interim traffic engineer for the City of Eugene. I've been with the city about 12 years, predominantly working in design and construction management of capital improvements like transportation improvements, streets, bike paths, sidewalks, wastewater, stormwater, airport, parks, kind of the whole gambit. Let me go back a slide here. So I'm here to talk about my study tour in Sweden and Denmark that I completed in September and October of last year. It was a 2.5-week study tour that focused on transportation safety and mainly Sweden's implementation of that, which is branded Vision Zero. I did spend a brief amount of time in Denmark, about 4 days, and learned some there as well. The study tour was sponsored by both the national and the state chapter of the American Public Works Association, and of course supported by the City of Eugene, so I'm very grateful for that. Just to get some perspective, I think we all know, but Sweden is in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. It's to the east of Norway and west of Finland. And as Europe is very compact, it's also very close to Russia, which was an interesting topic of conversation with folks over there since it was right before the election and how American politics might change relationships with Russia. Some comparisons with Oregon. So Sweden's almost twice as big as Oregon, so it's really not that big. It's got a little over twice as many people, so as a population density, it's actually fairly similar to Oregon. Stockholm is the biggest city, has about 900,000 in the metropolitan area, a little over 2 million, and then it has Gothenburg, which is kind of a second city similar to Chicago in the United States as opposed to New York. Some things that are very different, though, is the rate of vehicle ownership in Sweden. So out of 10 million people, there's only about 5.5 million cars, whereas in Oregon, we have about 4 million people and about 4.3 million cars. So we have a lot more motor vehicles in Oregon. But the piece that's really salient here, and the reason that we would look at a place like Sweden for transportation safety examples, is the number of fatalities they have per a million people in population. So in 2015, latest numbers, they had 27 fatalities per million people that year, and in Oregon we had 92. So they have more than three times less fatalities in Sweden. So there's definitely something there to learn from. Vision Zero is an ethical platform at its root, and as Juan Carlos said, it's really that no deaths or serious injuries are acceptable on the transportation system. That's the real core belief of it. It has a philosophy and a strategy around safety, and it's about shared responsibility between the street users and the designers. How it differs from traditional transportation safety is it really looks at fatalities and serious injuries. So it's not just all crashes and accidents. If there's a property damage crash, if you're car's fender gets hit, that's not exactly what our focus is. It's something we'd like to prevent, but we're really trying to prevent fatalities and serious injuries, the things that are impactful on people's lives, on families' lives. And it's interesting in the introduction that there was kind of a discussion about the trade-off between life and money, but even if you do try to associate the productivity of a life, you realize it's also a lot of money you lose. I think in the metropolitan area here of Eugene Springfield, it's something on the order of $200 or $300 million that you lose in productivity a year. So there's money there too, but it really is at its core about people. Some things that are different as well is you're trying to design the system for the physics of what the human body can take. So it's about lowering speed. That's really one of the core concepts. The more energy, the more speed you have, the more energy you put into a collision, the higher chance that someone's really going to get hurt. It shares the responsibility, again, between users and designers. In Sweden, it puts a primary responsibility on designers, but they also have some different laws that kind of help designers, the ability to set their own speed limits for the most part within cities, which we actually don't have here in Oregon. The set sets our speed limits. We can request a speed limit change, but we don't have the authority to change it ourselves for the most part. And they also have some different laws around driver responsibility. If, for instance, you hit a pedestrian, there's almost no way that you aren't partially liable as a driver if you hit a pedestrian in Sweden. It's about changing the environment. So instead of putting the onus on people to follow the law, we want them to follow laws, speed limits, whether they're going to, you know, where they're going to yield, things like that. You change the environment so that they more physically have to follow the law. So again, that comes down to things like traffic calming, roundabouts where you don't have the potential if someone runs a red light, they can run right into another car who's using the intersection. And really lastly, it's that people demand safety. That's an underlying tenet of Vision Zero as well, instead of mobility and just the ability to get around quickly being the main desire of our public. So when you take that from policy to action, that again translates to speed reduction. And in cities, that's a lot about traffic calming, and especially where people are going to cross the street. That may seem intuitive, but it's not always the way that we've implemented traffic calming in the United States. When you're in more rural areas on highways, if you are going 50 miles an hour or less, they put a system of traffic cameras in that monitor speed and issue citations if you're going above the speed limit. If you're going above 50 and there's a potential for a head-on collision, they separate with a cable rail. So if you're out on I-5, you see the cable rail they've been putting in the last few years. Imagine something like that in the middle of a highway. And I'll have a picture for our live audience to see later that kind of shows that. But it takes away that potential head-on collision. That also applies to vulnerable users like bicyclists. It doesn't mean that bicycles are on a street two blocks over from the main street. What it does mean is that on a main street, you'll have a bike facility that's up at sidewalk height behind a curb. So they're not in the roadway interacting with vehicles. In lots of ways, when you come to an intersection, you kind of proceed through it like a pedestrian would. That's different between Sweden and Denmark, and I'll kind of highlight that a little bit later. Safety systems in vehicles is also another large part of it. Volvo, obviously, is from Sweden, and they've come up with a large number of the innovations in safety in vehicles over the years. Corporate partners are part of Vision Zero in Sweden. It's about people in the community. It's about government. It's about business coming together and making this a priority. They have an internal directive within Volvo Cars and Volvo Trucks, which are actually separate companies, to get to zero accidents, actually. So it's even more aggressive than Vision Zero, which is focused on serious injuries and fatalities. And then lastly, collection and distribution of data, specifically crash and accident data. And I'll kind of talk about why I'm using those two terms separately in a little bit. So I'm showing a graph here, and it shows the rate of fatality in or fatalities by year in Sweden from 1970 to 2015. And what you'll see is it's a pretty steep decline. In 1970, they had about 1,300 fatalities a year. And fast forward to 2015, they're down to 260. Vision Zero started in 1997, adopted by Parliament. One of the things you might notice is there's not really much of a change in the slope of the line in 1997, so you might wonder what really changed when Vision Zero was adopted nationally. To some extent, maybe something stayed the same. It doesn't mean that transportation safety started in 1997. They had been working on this for years, especially cities like Gothenburg, started in the 1970s with traffic calming. So there was work already being done. But to a large part, this kind of follows the 80-20 rule, where you put 20% of the effort in to get 80% of the return. So most of the fatalities that were reduced in the 70s and 80s were about car crashes. So it's technology in cars that help people survive a crash and not have serious injury. So again, Volvo invented the shoulder seatbelt, and they mandated its use for drivers earlier than we did in the United States. So they get a lot of reduction there. They've done very, very well with reducing fatalities to drivers of automobiles. It's been more challenging for vulnerable users like bicyclists and pedestrians, but they have done a lot of work in certain cities there too. So when you get on the 1997 to 2015, what you are seeing there is more of a focus in pedestrian and bicycle safety. And that's kind of what Vision Zero 2.0 is in Sweden, is recalibrating nationally on a focus and kind of a consistency on pedestrian and bicycle safety. So Strada is the crash and accident data system they have there. And this is a really, from a transportation geek, this is an amazing thing. So not only do they have police data on crashes, which we have here in the United States, they also collect data at emergency rooms. So if people come in and they have an injury from a transportation-related event, whether it's a collision or maybe an accident, and in this case, when I say an accident, I'm talking about, you know, let's say on a bike you slip on the ice and fall, or you're walking as a pedestrian and you trip. I'm going to call that an accident. If there's a collision between two parties, I'm going to call that a crash. Okay, so if there's an accident like that, they're also collecting that data. We don't get that in the United States. We don't see that. We don't have a way to track it. And there's a lot of reasons why. Part of it is trying to build a coalition to report on it. Part of it is HIPAA and, you know, privacy around medical records. But it's something I'd really like to see us move towards, because what you get is a lot more information and perspectives on an event. So you might have a police crash report, but you might, for that same event, you might also have the emergency room data, and you might get a different perspective for each of the people that were injured on what actually happened there. So it gives a transportation professional trying to see if there's a solution from an infrastructure safety side or some other way to address it, more information to make a decision. What it's also led to, and I'm going to show some data from the city of Malmo, which is the first city in Sweden I visited and fell in love with, a great place. But in blue here, in this graph, it represents the amount of signal accidents from 2008 to 2012 in the city of about 300,000. In red, it's collisions. So what you see is that for pedestrians and bicyclists, people are mainly getting injured from single accidents, from tripping, from accidentally running off a path on their bike, from the fact that it's slippery when it's icy out because Sweden's pretty far north and they get a lot of snow. If you look at serious injuries and deaths, that same thing kind of holds true. And what you'll notice is that it's actually the opposite for cars. So most of the time, if you get injured in a car, it's in a collision, and that makes sense too. This is not meant to downplay the seriousness of collisions, but what it does highlight is Sweden's done a really good job reducing collisions. But now what they're seeing is, hey, now we need to focus on quality of our surfaces and maintenance. Those are almost as impactful. And it's just not a view behind the peek behind the curtain that we get here in the United States, but I think you can likely extrapolate that there's a similar opportunity here. Planning. It's very interesting in Sweden, all the cities I went to, they're very planning heavy. In fact, in the city of Stockholm, almost everything they do in kind of the equivalent public works group there is planning. They, for instance, they don't actually have maintenance staff that go out and fill potholes and clear snow. They have maintenance planners that plan that activity, and then they hire contractors to go do it. So it's a completely different model. Likewise, they don't design a street themselves. They'll hire contractors to do that, but they'll plan what they want the streets to look like. So they put a lot of emphasis on planning. Another thing that's different is that their cities start with a strategic plan for the entire city there. And they have a broader range of services under cities than we do. They also have schools up till higher education, and some part of the healthcare system is part of their cities. Their city government is very large. In Stockholm, they have 900,000 people, and 50,000 people work for the city. So a whole different scale and size of government and resource to the government than we have. In this picture, which you can't understand because it's in Swedish, what it basically shows is there's a strategic plan. Underneath the strategic plan, you'll have high-level plans like our transportation system plan, which is currently getting updated. They call theirs urban mobility planning. And under that, though, they have a safety plan and an environment plan. So all the work that goes into making decisions and planning about how you want to walk, how you want to bike, how you want to drive, freight, congestion in a city, all go through a lens of environment and safety. So it's just built right into their process. And one thing that was interesting there, talking to transportation professionals, is that there was just really no qualm about the importance. There wasn't maybe the discussion that you might see in the United States about efficiency versus safety and where that balance should fall. To there, it was the right thing to do. Transportation safety is the right thing to do. And I didn't hear any different opinion other than that while I was there. So areas of action. Again, baseline is working towards lower speeds and separating users where it's appropriate. This graph kind of tells it all. And this is, or not graph, but this photo or picture. And it's from Volvo, but City of Gothenburg often uses it in their presentations. And it talks about the maximum speed at which you want interactions to occur. So if you have the opportunity for a head-on collision between vehicles, you don't want the vehicles to be going more than 50 miles an hour. If you get above that, the chance of survival is very low. If you have cars driving in an area with pedestrians, you want it to be 25 or less. If you have the chance of a side collision, 45 or less. You don't want a difference in speed of more than 25 miles an hour if you have the potential for a rear-end collision. And if you hit a moose, you don't want to be going more than 70, which I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd want to be going 70 if I hit a moose. But again, it's kind of building the physics of the interaction. So as I've said, and I'll probably continue to saying a lot, in cities this is a lot about lowering speeds and providing traffic calming that physically puts you at that speed. It's not just about signs. It's about building the system so you travel the speed that is intended. And a lot of the traffic calming solutions are similar to what we have here in the United States and you might see around Eugene. For the most part, they use what we call vertical traffic calming, so a hump or a raised crosswalk or something that makes you go over it. They do use horizontal traffic calming that makes you kind of move in a sinuous maneuver. If for some reason it doesn't work for emergency services, but apparently it's very rare that they actually have to use that. As an example of the kind of systematic installation of this, the city of Gothenburg, which is about a city of about 500,000, they have 2,500 traffic calming installations. So it's not about, it's systematic in a way that's more preventative than taking care of a hot spot. So if you're on a main road and a side road comes into it, typically the pedestrian crossing across the side street is going to be raised. It's just like that. The tools that we put in place here in Eugene to date have been more of, we have a problem, we found a problem, let's try to address it. They're actually just building it into the design, the core design of their streets. One of the traffic calming features there that I found very interesting that we don't have is called the Malmo ramp, or the 7% ramp. But the concept basically is that you have this about 5 foot long ramp. It's between 5% and 7%. So when you hit that, it's going to cause you to decelerate. But on the back end, it comes back very gradually to the existing street grade. So you don't have that kind of violent rocking that can occur if you hit a speed hump or something at speed where you go up and down very quickly. And that doesn't really work very well for transit and also is not favored by emergency services. So this is something they actually put on main streets. This is something that you'd see on something like Coburg Road on an arterial street. In the United States, you don't typically see traffic calming like that on a main street. They also pair it with pedestrian crossings. So you can see the ramps about 20 feet in front of the crossing. Here's a crossing here. That allows pedestrians that are waiting in the cross to anticipate that a car is slowing. You know, there's a physical object that's going to help slow a car. You can see them decelerating while they're still far enough away from you that you can enter the crosswalk. So there's actually less delay in a pedestrian crossing. You don't have to wait for a car to get 5 feet from you and stop, which isn't really comfortable when you cross the street either. So I'd like to see us try to find opportunities to use something like this. I think it could kind of balance the needs of our emergency services folks and provide better ride for transit while still providing traffic calming. If you get out of the city, and again, if you're 50 or under, you're going to see speed traffic cameras along roads. They're placed at about every 3 miles on the roads that they have them, and typically they do identify that there's a speeding problem before they install them. They have about 1,600 installed right now. They put it between 1 and 200 in a year. I actually got to meet the one person in Sweden that approves all of them. And it's interesting, they're very systematic. So data, they're all about data. They collect a heap of data, which is great, I think. But she reviews the data and approves siting of all of these locations. They spend a lot of time trying to make these cameras seem non-threatening and aesthetically pleasing. You can judge for yourself whether or not you think that's true. They do report that they're very effective, that they lower fatalities and serious injuries about 20 to 30%, and they're pretty widely accepted by the public as a way to reduce speed. It's interesting because when you kind of get under the hood of it, they actually don't issue that many citations. So they have a driver responsibility in Sweden. So when they take a picture of a car that's speeding, you actually have to be able to match the face of the driver to an ID in order to issue a citation. What that means in practice is that if a picture is taken, about 1 in 4 actually are issued a citation. On top of that, they take a maximum of 260,000 photos a year, no matter how many people are speeding. And that's because, interesting thing in a social democracy, they've moved the jobs for reviewing the photos to a city up near the Arctic Circle, where it's great to sit at a desk in the wintertime and look at photos, and that's a way to make jobs in that city. But they have a maximum throughput of 260,000 photos a year. So there's another maybe 1 in 4 chance if you're actually speeding that a photo will be taken. So you know, you're down definitely less than a 1 in 10 chance that you're going to get a citation if you're speeding. And speeding in this context is 3 miles an hour over the speed limit. It's a tight band. But even with that, they have a remarkable success, not only a reduction of fatalities and serious injuries, which is the Vision Zero goal, but you can kind of see from this graph that these are the speeds that the percentage of people speeding on certain speed roads. And most roads, people were between 30 and 40% of people were speeding before they put the cameras in. Afterwards, all of them have less than 10% of people speeding. So it makes a big difference. And I drove on one of these highways, and it wasn't that everyone comes to a screeching, you know, slow down right before the camera. For the most part, people just travel through, and they're going the speed limit. If you have speeds over 50, and now we're to a point where we want to try and make sure that people don't have a head-on collision, that's where they put things in place, like the center cable rail. And what this road would have looked like before is kind of typical of Highway 99, except maybe with wider shoulders. So it'd be one lane each way, wide shoulders. And they come in and they reconfigure the road. They put the cable rail down the center line. And they do what they call a 2+1 configuration, which is two lanes in one direction and one in the other. And they alternate that. So if there is slow-moving freight or something like that, you don't have to stay behind them for 100 miles. You get your opportunity to pass when it's appropriate. So another action is creating a safe infrastructure for walking and biking. This is kind of an example of what a Swedish bike facility would look like in an urban area. Again, your bike facility, let's look at it this way. You've got your curb-to-curb width, which is where cars are. You've got your curb. If there's parking next to the curb, there's a few feet there for the door zone so people can get in and out of their vehicles. Then you have a bike facility that's typically between 6 to 12 feet, depending on the amount of traffic they expect in the bike facility. And behind that, they have a sidewalk. So it kind of goes from the highest speed user to the lowest as you move away from the center line. In Sweden, these facilities are two-way typically, so they might only have a bike facility on one side of the street and you can go whichever direction you want on it. That's very different in Denmark. They are very adamant that if you have a street side bike facility, you're going the direction of car traffic. So just diverging opinions there. What's interesting about this as a pedestrian, I actually think it works well as a cyclist. It works pretty well as a pedestrian, but if you're going to cross the street as a pedestrian, you do have to walk through the bike facility, so you need to be really aware of if bikes are coming. And one of the things that they saw in Malmo, where they were seeing this, collisions, is that they actually are having a higher rate of collisions between bicycles and pedestrians because their mode share is going up so high with bicycles, about 30%. So when you get that many people biking, you will have some collisions between people walking and biking. Another example, this shows a cargo bike with, I think it's four kids in it. That was not uncommon to see people taking their kids to preschool on a cargo bike like that. In Copenhagen, I think it's one out of three families with two children or more have a bike like this. So it's a part of their daily life. What you can see in this picture is that when you approach an intersection, you have your own set of lights for the bicycle that's very similar to the lights for a crosswalk for pedestrians. If you're going to make a left turn, you do it in two stages. So you're up at curb height. You don't go into traffic and get in the left turn lane to make a left turn. You stay in your facility. You go through the intersection, and then you turn 90 degrees, and you go the other way using the lights. So, you know, it's a system of how to bike that's very different than the one we currently have in the United States. When we have street-level bike lanes, typically you're going to move over into the left turn lane. You're going to take the lane to make a turn. So if we were to look at implementing a system like this, you really have to re-educate people how to use it as well. Not all of these facilities are ideal. This is a photo in Stockholm of about a 4-foot bike facility that kind of weaves through the sidewalk and through trees. Doesn't really look like a very comfortable way to bike or walk. And one thing that I saw is that in the early iterations of their bicycle facilities, often they were taking space from the pedestrian facility. And that has changed. So for about the last 10 years, when they're building new facilities, they're actually starting to take room from the street where cars are operating for bicycles and kind of restoring the pedestrian environment. Now, again, they don't do this without studying it because they study everything. But, they have They have a lot of cars, but they also have a lot of other ways to get around. About 50% of people in Stockholm use transit. And then you have, you know, biking and walking too, and then you have your cars. So they're able to balance, you know, the level of service that they have on the road for vehicles with every other mode that every other option that they have for people to move around. A lot of shared streets and, you know, squares where not only do people, you know, maybe sit and picnic, but they ride, they walk, and occasionally a car will go through. If you're biking or walking in these areas, you proceed at the speed of someone walking. That's what the expectation in the signage tells you. Kind of a little difference in Copenhagen. Now we're going to shift. Now we're in Denmark. And it might seem a little similar, but one of the differences with this facility in Copenhagen is it's not at curb height, this bike facility. It's actually between the curb height for the sidewalk and the street. So it's up a couple inches to the bike facility, then up a couple more inches to the sidewalk. Now this is an example where you can see that this is not a great sidewalk. And being that it's Copenhagen, anywhere there's a chance to lock a bike, there is one locked. So it's not a great experience here. This is maybe an example of one of the streets where they go back and try to reclaim some room for the pedestrian environment. This is an example of where they did that. They actually came back and rebuilt about a 12-foot bike lane. They took a vehicle lane out on each side and then expanded a sidewalk back. It's across the bridge and they have a lot of traffic there. What's different when you get to intersections in Copenhagen, you can kind of see in the foreground where the facility is raised up to a couple inches above the street. But when it goes through an intersection, it comes down to grade, and there's actually a mixing of bikes and right turn vehicle traffic. Also, bikes typically are using the vehicle traffic signals, so there's not a separate set of signals for them. It's not always true, but mostly. So there is more of a mixing of modes in Copenhagen, but there are so many people biking, and again, they have slower speeds in their urban areas that that seems to work, and people biking seem to feel very confident that that space is theirs. Just an example in Copenhagen of the kind of facilities that they're building for biking. This is called the Snake Bridge. It goes over one of the canals in Copenhagen. It is just for bikes. It is a very stunning architectural facility, but it's just for bikes. You don't walk on it. You don't drive on it. It is a bike connection. This is kind of an example of the Green Wave in Copenhagen, and what that is on major routes, they'll time the traffic signals for bikes, and in the morning commute, this was a really rainy day, and I apologize for the photo because people were moving quickly, but it's kind of a wave. It's 60 people will go by, and you'll wait 30 seconds, and another 60 people will go by. It's just a continuous movement of bicycles in the commuting hours. Downtown, well, I guess it's actually within the city limits of Copenhagen. I think the ridership is up about 50%. So, I mean, a lot of bikes. What that translates to is a lot of need for bike parking. This is their central station. They have two-story bike parking. You often saw this in Sweden as well. But one of the frustrations they have, this is a public square. And I actually stayed with a family. The woman we stayed with was an urban planner for the city of Copenhagen. This was very frustrating to her because any open area basically turned out to be bike parking, and it really kind of took away from this public space for other uses as well. Now, if you think about how many parking spots for cars you'd need for that many people, then you've really got a problem. But nonetheless, this is not really very desirable for their public space. Another area of action is improving operations and maintenance of biking and walking facilities. City of Stockholm is kind of way out in front on this, and you know, remember, they do get quite a bit of winter weather there, but they maintain about over 150 kilometers of bike facility with snow removal in the wintertime, and it is a priority for them. They have small specialized pieces of equipment that remove the snow, can apply de-icing fluid, and again, this is a contractor, because in Stockholm, they contract out their maintenance, but the contractor, the maintenance planning folks, are actually working with the university to test the effectiveness of different de-icing fluids at different temperatures. It's kind of amazing the level of detail they go to make sure this is a safe facility. They can also use these machines in the fall when they're trying to do leaf removal on a path. They can use their high-pressure water jets to clean the path. And they also can shoot sideways and clean shelters and benches as well, so they're pretty usable. These guys actually will also perform first aid. So if they come across someone that's injured, they'll perform first aid and get emergency services there. So it's kind of amazing. Behavior measures, like we do in the United States and is fairly common around the world, they have educational materials in Copenhagen. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Sometimes Google it in YouTube. They have some really pretty graphic and pretty impactful commercials about traffic safety, about impaired driving, about distracted driving. This is an example here from Malmo where they just have some graphics they put together kind of saying, hey, if you're biking, don't look at your phone while you're biking because you might end up in an ambulance. And the last one I love, which again comes when you have a lot of bikes and pedestrians interacting, is don't harass the pedestrian. You can see pedestrians and babies and trash cans flying as the bike goes ripping past. Just if you're in an area where there's mixed modes, then proceed slowly. And they really work very hard to integrate education on across their organizations and having a shared vision about what transportation safety means for them. So again, it's not only pervasive within the organization, it is a cultural thing. Vision Zero doesn't work if everyone's not on board. And this is a social democracy, and there's some difference between kind of the view of individual rights versus a collective good there. But I think even translating to the United States, we can all think about or have experienced some tragedy on a transportation system. I don't think you have to be a social democracy for this to make sense. Okay, so that was kind of the meat, and I have maybe 4 or 5 more minutes. I just want to talk about a couple general observations. One, just very multimodal there. This is a picture showing buses, separated bike facilities, crosswalks, and there's tram tracks here. So, I mean, you go into these cities, and there's people using every mode you can think of. City of Gothenburg has so much so many trams built out, which are, a trolley or tram, that they can't do it anymore. They've basically taken so much street space with trams, they need to now think about building a subway. They've maximized that ability. The inner city train system is pretty amazing. If anyone's traveled to Europe, you probably know that. It works very well, and a lot of people do use that to come into work. Bike share, I think every city that I went to except one had a bike share system. And Eugene is going to have one shortly. Some interesting innovations. On the left, we have a articulated bus, but it has two articulations. That's their bus rapid transit system in Malmo. So, our bus rapid transit system, we have a very long bus, two solid sections and a bend. This has two bends and three sections. One of the things that was interesting about it, though, is that it looks the same from both ends, even though it only goes one way. So when they first built it, there was some confusion of which direction it was going to go. The other thing, though, is a Holding product. This is basically an airbag bike helmet. And actually, there was a lot of discussion about this while I was there, but when you put it on, it kind of just looks like a scarf. It kind of zips in the front and goes around your neck. It has an accelerometer, and if it senses that you're moving in an unnatural motion, it inflates immediately, like an airbag does. And it has very good testing for preventing brain trauma. Now, it doesn't work. It's not in the U.S., and there's a couple reasons why. One, we do puncture testing, which doesn't work so well with this. And the other is we drop a weight from a height, and trying to coordinate the weight dropping with the helmet inflating, because it comes up to a peak pressure and then, starts to lose pressure, it just doesn't work. But that might be something we see in the future. One of the fellows that I talked to had one and actually had it accidentally inflate when he kind of slipped on his bike, and he said it was starting to strangle him and it was over his eyes. He didn't know what was going on. But what's kind of great about it is it actually immobilizes your neck. So not only does it provide protection for your head, it immobilizes your neck. Just a funny thing there, they have a very strong coffee culture in Sweden, one of the things I experienced, and they have something called fika. So they drink coffee in the morning, they drink it at 9, they drink it with lunch, and at 2 p.m. you have fika, which is kind of like a tea time. And it's a chance for people to come together, and they typically drink coffee and have a kanebule, which is a cinnamon roll or some pastry, and talk. It promotes interaction, and which I think we now know interactions promote innovation. So it's an interesting cultural piece there. But I drank more coffee than I ever have in my entire life, so I had to dry out from that. So actually, I think just due to time, I'll stop my presentation there, and we can go on with questions.
All right, so our first question here today is our very own Rob Seiko. He's a local transportation activist and executive director of BEST, Better Eugene Springfield Transit, a coalition of community leaders and organizations supporting transit. Rob is also a City Club member. So the first question here is here to either add more into the conversation or sometimes to see about presenting a different perspective that our guest speaker might be able to answer. Rob, are you ready?
Yeah. Good. Thank you, Juan Carlos. Thank you, Matt. I'd like to bring us from Europe to this country, and as you know, in the United States, the long-term trend is good, is that fatalities have been declining, seat belts, airbags, and things like that. But most recently, we've seen a shocking increase in fatalities. In the United States, from 2014 to 2015, they increased by 8%. Oregon actually had the highest percentage increase in fatalities from 2014 to 2015 of any state. And 2015 being the last year where we have data, Lane County had more fatalities than any other county in Oregon. So we have a problem here locally. And my question to you is just, what are the top three things you learned? Or what from Sweden and Denmark could we be doing here, do you think we should be doing here in Eugene and Lane County? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I'll... So I think I probably didn't address this earlier, which I should have, but the City of Eugene adopted Vision Zero in November as a city goal, and we are in the middle of creating a Vision Zero action plan. We have a Vision Zero task force of a little under 20 community members working on that right now. If you are interested in that, you can actually find materials from those meetings at www.eugene-or.gov/Vision Zero, or just Google City of Eugene Vision Zero, and you can actually sign up for the newsletter. But we actually are trying to work on identifying what those things are here locally. We have a countywide transportation safety plan and a kind of metro area safety plan that are just going through adoption. We have a statewide safety plan that ODOT's worked on. So kind of the stars are aligning for doing more work on safety here. And we want to have those work together and build off the work that's done previously to the greatest extent possible. But a few things, again, that really struck me were that this has to be a community effort. We all have to really buy into it to make it meaningful, and that it takes time. So this isn't something that happened overnight. We do have a problem in the state and in the city with traffic violence, and it'll take us all working together to do it, and it might mean that we need to put more resources towards it. Internally, we're already starting to change our practice to the extent we can to align with Vision Zero. So as a traffic engineer, I work with traffic operations, the way we work with signals and stop signs, and just the way we handle complaints. So we've started to change our priorities so that serious injuries and fatalities are our number one thing we're focusing on, and then we kind of go down the line to things that are less severe. We're changing the way that we're looking at traffic calming. So we have one particular traffic calming project where we changed the way we were going to place the traffic calming measures to try and associate them more with slowing people down at pedestrian crossings. When you look at kind of guidance in the United States, that it's kind of allowed, but it's not typically the standard. But it makes a lot of sense, and we're going to do that. So I don't know. Does that get to your question there, Rob? But yeah, I mean, I think we're making efforts, and there's a lot of work community-wide to focus on it and go forward on it. But again, it'll take a sustained community investment to really make this work.
All right, club members, let's take a quick break.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Greetings, Mariah Learn. Many people have reason to believe that some aspects of Smart City Vision Zero are really about government spying on an unimaginable scale, especially the use of revenue generative surveillance and ticket cameras that threaten our privacy. I certainly hope the ACLU and the Civil Liberties Defense Center will look into this. Has your plan, or the Vision Zero plan, considered an alternative to intersection ticket cameras? Studies show that all red light clearance intervals reduce intersection accidents, as does increasing the yellow light time. And have you looked into what's referred to as the roller barrier system, where drivers who edge over to barriers on freeways and off-ramps are guided back into the line of traffic rather than causing a collision? If safety is really the motive rather than revenue generation and government surveillance, I hope the city looks into some of these alternatives. Thank you.
Okay. So first I just want to say in the city we're not looking at freeway safety measures because we don't work on freeways in the city. We're working on city streets. So roller barrier is not something that would be appropriate for a city street. Many cities do use some form of camera enforcement, both for red lights and for speed. In Oregon, only Portland can use it for speed. They have a pilot project without having an officer present. So you can have a van with an officer in it that can have photo radar that enforces speed, but you can't have it without the officer except in Portland. A number of cities, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 in Oregon, actually do have red light cameras. And there's controversy around them. I think Portland's studies on their photo speed radar actually show a lot of promise in reducing speeds. And reducing speeds is the point in getting to a lot of the reduction in fatalities and serious injuries. If you can't afford to completely redesign the street to have physical traffic calming, then sometimes cameras are, I think, a viable option. Now, red light cameras also have had some scandal. City of Chicago, if anyone has paid attention to that, is one of those unfortunate implementations where there was, you know, some unethical use of that, where there were payoffs to city government officials for installations, and the CEO of a particular company that supplies that service went to jail. That doesn't mean it's not a useful tool, but it needs to be ethically put in place, and revenue generation can't be the point of it. And I don't know if we'll look at using any of those systems. We're certainly going to do due diligence to research them, but we're in the right now we're putting the action plan together, so we don't have a final product on what it's going to look like as far as the menu of options.
I'm Jack Dresser. I've done research over a number of years on DUI prevention for NHTSA and for National Institutes of Health. And one of the things that you didn't really mention was the Swedish systems and the Danish systems regarding drunk driving. They have a lower per se limit, meaning the blood alcohol level that is considered legally intoxicated. 0.05, I think, in Sweden and Denmark. And also they have very draconian sanctions. And they also have much more population density in both Stockholm and Copenhagen than we see here, so people do use public transportation a lot more. But what I was wondering, from a research point of view, you really need to look at traffic fatalities per miles driven as opposed to per capita. And I was wondering, with these things have been introduced sequentially in these communities, I wonder if there was a research methodology to identify the incremental changes, incremental improvements in traffic fatalities for each one of these innovations.
Okay. I think just to respond to the question at the end, that there is a lot of research. Like I said, Sweden pours a lot of money into collecting data. I don't have that at my fingertips right now. Luckily, I've made a lot of good contacts in Sweden. And we also in the U.S. have a lot of research on transportation safety measures, different things that will reduce crashes if implemented at crosswalks and other pieces. So there's a lot of data driven analysis that we can do on this.
Okay, I'll be quick. I'm Ralph Pledger. I've been a member about 2 months, enjoying it. My question is, can you expand on how we can move our anti-government sentiment toward more trust in government and specifically transportation planning?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, so I do think that one of the things that they have in Europe, maybe not across the board, but definitely in Sweden, and I've heard in Switzerland and other countries, is kind of a view of government and specifically in this case transportation professionals as someone you can trust to do the right thing for you. That is not always the case in the United States. I'd like to think that in Eugene, we try very hard to establish that trust. It's probably a matter of perspective, how you feel about it. But I think part of it is following through on what you say you're going to do. And I think good examples of that in transportation have been our pavement bond measures, where we've said to the community, here's what we want to do. Do you support doing it? And you've said yes, and we went ahead and did it. So for me, that's kind of a core foundation of gaining trust. Saying you do what you're going to do, being responsive when people are talking to you, when people have concerns, hearing them out and trying to be empathetic. And if you can't address their concern, letting them know why very clearly.
Thank you so much for coming. It's really interesting. My name is Susan Conley. I'm a City Club member. And my question is, even though it's against the law and very unsafe, the skateboards and bicycles continue to use the sidewalks in downtown Eugene. So is your commission going to address that problem and perhaps come up with some good signage?
So I will say again, this work is more broad than that. And it's also looking at where there are serious injuries and fatalities. So because something's unsafe doesn't necessarily mean that it actually leads to a fatality or serious injury. So we're going to look at the places that are the highest priority. Typically, downtown is not the place we see a lot of serious injuries and fatalities because, for the most part, until you get on 6 and 7, people are moving pretty slowly in cars. And there's enough going on with interaction with pedestrians and maybe bicycles and skateboarders, even though they aren't supposed to be riding downtown on the sidewalks, that people drive more carefully. So we're doing a lot of data analysis with Lane Council of Governments and drawing on the work that the county did in their safety plan to look at high crash corridors and intersections and the real places that we need to focus based on data. Vision Zero is a very data-driven approach.
My name is Wendy Wheeler Coltrane. I've been a City Club member for a while. My question is, in terms of Willamette Street, the changes that have been made in around 25th to 28th, 29th Street, that it was, there's been a lot of back and forth about it, and I was wondering if there have, from your perspective, whether the changes that have been made are effective, and has there been any review about that, and will there be any community input allowed?
Sure. So, as you know, the South Willamette Project is a trial project. So there's a period of a year where we'll have the change and it'll go back to council and they'll make a final decision on what that street looks like. We're a little too early to make a data comparison yet. What I can tell you anecdotally is that we've heard a lot of good feedback from people about not only having a biking facility on Willamette, but actually that it's much more comfortable to walk on Willamette because you now have that bike lane. So cars aren't right next to the sidewalk, which is a curbside sidewalk. It's more logical when you use it. If you're going to go straight through, you stay in the same lane for the most part. But that doesn't mean that that's how everyone feels. You know, I think there are times of day, right at peak usage, where there's longer queues to get through. And that's something from traffic operations that we are looking at, especially, I think, in the AM northbound at 29th. It can back up a little bit, but it clears up pretty quickly. So I would say we're not there yet on being able to present the data on before and after, but that will be something coming up. And when it does come back to council, obviously there's a chance to have your voice heard.
Joshua Scove, City Club member, also member of the City of Eugene Budget Committee. Just funding, I'm curious, can we just transform the way we spend money now from current funding sources, or in your experience from, you know, what you saw in Sweden, from thinking about our context here, do we need new revenue sources?
That's a great question. I would say that we're probably not there yet in figuring that out. I think the action plan will be part of that, because the action plan will put together what our strategies are going forward and the actions that we're going to carry out. I think I can say, though, from observing in Sweden, they have a lot more tax revenue in that country. So there's not a lot of barrier to them being able to install measures to improve transportation safety. So additional resource is obviously going to be helpful, a resource for staff, a resource for construction. But, you know, whether I think there's still impact we can make within the current amount of money allocated to transportation just in the way that we change our focus. But we'll see what potential budget needs could be based on what the outcome of the action plan is.
The City of Eugene wants to thank our sponsors, including the Oregon Country Fair, Hearing Associates, KLCC 9.7 Radio. Our programs are live on TV Monday through Friday and Saturday and Sunday, every Monday on the radio at 6:30 p.m. at KLCC. Our next week program is Running the Gauntlet, a discussion about the challenges experienced by minority students in a highly charged post-election setting. Speakers will include Dr. Gustavo Valderas, Dr. Susan Reckie-Smith, teacher Dina James, and Outteach director Julie Hefferman. That's next Friday, January the 20th. I hope you can join us. Bring a friend with you if you can. Additional information about future programs, membership, and other opportunities how to volunteer, you can find them at www.cityclubofeugene.org. Now, help me thank once again our speaker for his presentation.